This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Tuesday Hometown with Joan Bartlett, and I'll be here for the next 2 hours. And once again, a great big thank you to all the people who have donated to this program for the Radiothon. 30th of June coming up pretty quick. If you haven't decided yet or you're thinking about it, please do so soon, and then you can have your tax-deductible receipt for the end of the financial year and have that great feeling that you're helping to keep 3CR on air for our big birthday next year. With the US now officially in another war, not just supplying the weapons and the know-how and everything else, we look at the plight of Palestinians living in Israel with Palestinian Australian Noura Mansour, senior lecturer at RMIT, Binoy Campmark, with a focus on Netanyahu, his background, his mentors, his plans for the State of Israel. Former diplomat, writer, and academic Richard Bronowski looks at the obedience of the Albanese government to the US. These last two interviews were recorded just prior to the latest US war actions in Iran. And finally, genetic engineering news with the executive officer of the Gene Ethics Network, Bob Phelps. But first, let's hear it from Mr. Kevin Healy with his week that was.
A week, Jane, listener, when as Zion unilaterally expanded its slaughter and destruction to evil Iran, and then the peace-loving US of the UN of the US of the world joined the mass slaughter and destruction, we knew this would be the final straw for our courageous government, courageous socialists, and we were spot on. Big Supremo Anthony Albanese, poor Anthony, left at the altar by Donald. Anthony and the minister for going overseas all the time and being a perfectly good little prefect, penny left wing, and the minister for being offensive and train killing Richard Malls, the bad guys, immediately expressed their righteous anger at this unprovoked aggression. They attacked evil Iran, a threat to peace in the region, Penny drawled. So it seems evil Iran bombed itself. Not seems, undoubtedly, for Anthony and Penny and Richard and the rest of them must know what they're talking about. They know we must be thankful the free world, the world of liberty, freedom and democracy, has its bastion of democracy in the Middle East, good, good Zion, to defend and protect that liberty, freedom and democracy, in which, of course, freedom means the inalienable right of capital to be free to do what it likes, because that is always for the common good. And my word, doesn't Zion take its defend responsibility seriously, defending just everywhere? And again, of course, we are seeing all three, liberty, freedom and democracy, running riot in Donald's Trample the Poor, Making America Great Again. So when Zion continues its slaughter, destruction and genocide through slaughter, destruction and starvation in the non-land, non-peoples, non-land in Gaza, Anthony, Penny and Richard and the rest of them applaud Zion's right as an occupying force to defend itself against those who resist being occupied. And when Zion continues its slaughter, destruction, genocide and land seizures in the non-land, non-peoples, non-land in the West Bank, they iterate Zion's right as an occupying power to defend itself against those who resist being occupied. And when Zion claims evil then, but not now, evil Syria's Golan Heights as Zion and invades the rest of Syria, they confirm Zion is exercising its right to defend itself. And when Zion regularly bombs and destroys in Lebanon, Anthony and Penny and Richard and the rest of them criticized Lebanon as an evil bastion of terrorism, and again confirm good, good liberty, freedom and democracy, Zion's right to defend itself. And when Zion joins Donald in bombing and destroying in Yemen, they applaud Donald and Zion for exercising their right to defend themselves against evil terrorism. And when, well, there's a clear pattern of defending the free world, and sure, the people of all those places, the non-land, non-people for 77 years, live in terror of Zion's right to defend itself, but only because the terrorized are all terrorists. If we have any doubts, ask Anthony and Penny and Richard and the rest of them, who will confirm all that. Given that Zion is simply exercising its Yahweh-given right bestowed by a mere 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, and there can be no doubt about the authenticity of that right, Yahweh-given right to defend itself, its right to all the land from the river to the sea and everywhere else, then it's all positive. Showing that terrorist chant calling for the land from the river to the sea to be shared by all races and all religions and all creeds is so cruelly, cruelly anti-Semitic. And indeed, there are some very, very big winners from all this defending. Headlines in the past week clarifying that. Firms make hay from Europe defence crisis. UK to spend billions on new weapons. UK to build 12 attack submarines in a move to war-ready footing. Yes, the merchants of death are rubbing their hands together all the way to the slaughterhouse bank. And a pure coincidence, evil Iran negotiators were on their way to continue discussing what Donald calls a deal, perhaps the same deal he unilaterally tore up 7 years ago, which Iran was observing, on their way, and bang, Zion unilaterally invades, leading Donald with his impeccable logic to say Iran doesn't want a deal, leading only the most cynical to suggest a deal is the last thing good Zion wants. Now let's make it clear, the rigid, fanatical Iranian theocracy, its oppression of women, its crushing of any dissent, deserves to be replaced, but that is not the role of Zion or its US old partner in crime. And none of them should have a nuclear industry or nuclear weapons, and no one should bomb hospitals. But what hypocrisy for Zion Supremo Benjamin Not Another Yahu to decry the bombing of a Zion hospital as a war crime. Yes, it is, but Benjamin Not Another Yahu decrying the bombing of a hospital as a war crime, does he never listen to what he's saying, never have the slightest awareness? Meanwhile, congratulations to the University of Melbourne for upholding its principles of free speech, free debate, free thought by expelling students for criticising that right to defend itself and, worse, calling for an end to the slaughter, destruction and genocide. The Vice-Chancellor, Emma Johnston, was herself a student activist once. But like Anthony Albanese, who used to support the non-land, non-people terrorists against the 77 years of terror, they are proof of the value of maturity, of the Shavian adage that youth is wasted on the young. Mention how Donald Trample the Poor is upholding the great principles of liberty, freedom and democracy. Well, to be fair, he's certainly upholding the freedom of capital bit, expressed by yet another executive order placing a total ban on citizens from a dozen countries entering the US of, and yet another tough one, listener, but can we detect any sort of pattern here? Afghanistan, Myanmar, Chad, Republic of Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Eritrea, Haiti, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen. No, I can't spot a pattern there either, listener. An even tougher one, leaving me totally confused, but hoping your greater knowledge can set me straight. Abu Dhabi is attempting to take over one of our favourite fossils, Santos the Prophets, and other Gulf oil giants, the story read, have also been scrambling to capture a slice of the LNG market, convinced that gas will be sought after. And here's where I'm having real trouble and need your wiser help. Sought after as the world moves away from fossil fuels. What am I missing? Which bit of gas is not a fossil fuel? Something else we all missed. Richard Moore's The Bad Guys assured us the US Op review of the onomatopoeic Forcus train killer deal was routine and does not threaten True Blue Aussie handing billions and billions, $38 million a day for 30 years, real figure, to the US Op and His Most Gracious Majesty's home country, Merchants of Death. All new governments do it, he said. We did it. We did? And here were we, thinking we buckled at the knees when ScoMo announced the Forcus billions and sycophantically upped the ante from there. Perhaps Richard could show us the results of our review. Oh no, of course, that would probably, certainly be a security risk. Harking back to the fossils, the new Minister for Fossil Environment, Murray Swatch the Environment, says his new environment protection laws must accept compromise by all parties, by long-haired commie greenie environmentalists, so it can be business as usual. And business as usual must compromise by agreeing the legislation should speed up approval processes, eliminate red tape, and more particularly, annoying green tape. Murray says his predecessor, Tania Plibersek, the bill's bill, couldn't get through. But Murray, that bill intended genuinely to protect the environment, and at the behest of the Western Troublemosi socialists and their resource industry puppeteers, Anthony pulled the rug from under Tania's feet. Otherwise, it could have got through. And that was the problem. What was the problem? It would have protected the environment. The issue was summed up by this headline in last Friday's Troublemosi Capitalist Review. ALP environment overhaul will not focus on climate. Well, as if there's some connection. Seriously, what the hell then will it do? Meanwhile, as our state socialists, among others, plead for and offer incentives for AI industry and its data centres to set up here, data centres whose electricity use will make the Portland Aluminium Smelter's power use look like a drop in the ocean, and speaking of water, also require oceans of H2O coming from who knows where, AI, which the industry admits will cost jobs and or turn many workers into robotic slaves, leading evil unions to call for consultation and involvement as AI evolves, leading in turn that caring business class party champion of Zion's right to defend itself, Dave Sharma, to add the defence of AI and data centres to his arsenal, putting the workers' outrageous claims into perspective with his usual sense of balance. The idea that trade unions should be able to exercise some sort of veto over the use of artificial intelligence is retrograde and risks Troublemosi falling behind the rest of the world. Heaven forbid. And thank goodness Dave has cleared that one up using his everyday intelligence, of which that is a fine example. How dare workers want to say in changes in matters that affect them? Trust caring employers, trust the market. Dave would also be pleased that good old capitalist law, the High Court, with its renowned wisdom, ruled that the aforementioned Murray, on behalf of the socialists sacking the evil CFMEU, without the right to proper process to test the untested media allegations, was proper, legal, leading that well-known construction worker and King's Counsel Black Mark Irv doing fine to boast he can now get down to the important business of sadly having to let go lots and lots of workers, while the caring employers are rubbing their hands together. But of course, the weather has been cold. No need, of course, to sack the minister, good corporate citizens who may make the odd inadvertent error, like a few weeks ago we reported NDIS provider, or perhaps more correctly, non-provider, Cocoon, had been suspended for ripping off its workers and clients, but had recommended they transfer to another mob called Crescent, but forgot to mention it, Cocoon, had been suspended, or that it also owned Crescent. And now, surprise, surprise, Crescent has also been charged with failure to pay its workers and participants left without support and missing medications. Perhaps they can refer their neglected clientele back to Cocoon, if and when the suspension is lifted. Just go round and round. Hard as it is to believe, the NDIS Commission is investigating their parent company, Horizon Soul Solutions, which we assume stands for Horror Eyes on the Profits. And finally, telecommunications good corporate citizen copped a $100 million fine for making a few little mistakes, ripping off hundreds of vulnerable, disadvantaged, disabled and terra nullius non-land, non-people people. All inadvertently, of course, unlike evil unions. Good afternoon.
Did you know that each donation over $2 you make to 3CR's Radiothon is tax deductible? That means that when you're doing your tax return business, you can claim your 3CR donation as a legitimate tax deduction. To make a pledge to this year's Radiothon, call the station on 9419 8377 or donate online at 3cr.org.au. 3cr.org.au/donate. Your station, your voice.
3CR, your station, your voice.
These weapons are pointed at all of us. Take it personally.
And we need to be standing with communities on the front lines and really amplifying their fight and their voices.
And fight this until Australia is no longer one of the leading weapons manufacturers.
3CR, your station, your voice.
The plight of Palestinians living in the State of Israel has been highlighted in recent days as war rages between Israel and Iran. Jewish residents of Israel have access to protective spaces, while for Palestinians it is clear that the Israeli defence system is built to exclude its Palestinian citizens. But this is just the latest example of the segregation, discrimination, marginalisation and poverty experienced by Palestinians living in Israel. Today we look at that population and what lives are like for them. They make up 21% of the total population. I spoke with Noura Mansour, National Director of Democracy in Colour, educator and political analyst, and asked her first about the lives of the people living within those borders of Israel.
I want to answer this question, but I think maybe it's better if I just start by saying a few words about Gaza.
Absolutely.
Because obviously that's where things are quite happening at the moment, and we don't want to be distracting from Gaza. So I think maybe just to provide some context to your listeners, Jan, Gaza currently is going through an active genocide. For the last 2 years, we have been witnessing, watching day in, day out, the extermination of over 2 million Palestinians in Gaza. But just to put things in perspective, for the last 20 years, Gaza has been under siege, complete blockade, where Israeli authorities decide who goes in and out, what goes in and out of Gaza, including food and medical supplies. But to go back also a little bit for a much broader context, for the last 8 decades, Palestinians across the historic Palestine, so that's in Gaza, the West Bank, or in 1948, that is, as the international community likes to call it today, Israel, the Palestinians have been subjected to ongoing ethnic cleansing, crimes against humanity, and basically a low-intensity genocide at the hands of Zionist militia and the Israeli state. I think it's important, but also to kind of tie that back, today, recent polls in Haaretz, there was an article that presented a few interesting numbers there. That article was published in May recently, and it showed that 82% of the Jewish Israelis support ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians in Gaza. So at the same time, there was 66% of the Jewish Israelis who support the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians who are Israeli citizens who currently live as internally displaced people on their ancestral land. In today's Israel, there's over 20% of the population there are Palestinians. We're talking about almost 2.1 million people living as Israeli citizens who became internally displaced during the Nakba in 1948. For instance, like my family who hailed from Safad in the Upper Galilee and then became internally displaced, went to Haifa and then settled in Akka. Most of the people basically in the Galilee and inside 1948 who currently live in homes, in towns and villages, do not originate from those towns and villages because they became internally displaced people. And just to remind your listeners as well, in 1948, Israel destroyed over 500 towns and villages in Palestine. And until today, these towns and villages stand, the ruins stand there, and Palestinians, even Palestinians who are Israeli citizens, are not allowed to return to those towns and villages to rebuild and live ancestral towns and villages. So the right of return then comes a theme across refugees, but also internally displaced Palestinians in Israel. And this is only one of the rights that they are denied by the Israeli project. But let me just one more sentence about those numbers that I shared. The fact that that's almost 70% of Israeli Jews who live side by side, quote unquote, next to Palestinians who are indigenous to that land, support the expulsion of their, quote unquote, fellow citizens. But this is not a new or recent trend, because there was another poll in Haaretz as well in 2016 that showed that 50% at that stage supported the expulsion of Palestinian Israeli citizens, and 80% of Israeli society supported the project of Zionism as a Jewish supremacy, in that sense that they believe that it's okay to discriminate against Palestinians and privilege Israeli Jews. So this is a trend that is not recent. The fact that the Zionist project and the Israeli state and government have sought to empty and expel Palestinians from ancestral land is not something new. And this is tied, you know, this social public sentiment is also supported and underpinned by systemic and structural factors that are, you know, basically discriminatory and racist against Palestinians.
Can I take you back to 1947, 1948, mainly 1948, with the establishment of the State of Israel? We know that they destroyed all the villages within Palestine. Did they also destroy Palestinian villages within the new State of Israel?
Yes. So those over 500 towns and villages in 1947 and 1948 are within today's Israel. So they are towns in the Galilee, near Haifa, near Akka, near Yaffa. So yes, absolutely.
And when you say that 21% of Palestinians live within Israel, what do you mean? What is life for those people? How do they live?
So 20% of the citizens in Israel are Palestinians, indigenous people. So they are people who have inhabited the historic Palestine for over 4,000 years. However, in 1948, when Zionist militias sought to empty the Palestinians from their land through massacres and crimes against humanity and forcefully evicting over 75% of the Palestinian people, and then they established, obviously, the Israeli state, in which later on, up until this day, is basically a state that privileges Jewish people. It's a Zionism. It's important to tie back to Zionism as a Jewish ethnocentric supremacist ideology, as a settler colonial ideology, similar to the settler colonial project here on this stolen land that sought to empty the indigenous population, be that through extermination or ethnic cleansing, and then setting up systems and structures to sustain and perpetuate the ongoing, I guess, victimization and targeting of indigenous people. So how does that reflect in Israel? There are over 65 to 70 laws that discriminate against Palestinians in Israel, from land ownership to family reunification to the right of return and so many other laws. Palestinians who are indigenous to Palestine that are living currently as Israeli citizens live as second-class citizens. But also, we can see that they pose a real challenge and an issue for the expansion of the Zionist project. And that's why we hear continuous calls of expelling Palestinians in Israel, but also, you know, describing them such as the cancer from within and all that dehumanizing language that Israeli politicians and society have been consistently using against Palestinians in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Israel, and actually in the diaspora as well.
When we talk about the Palestinians in Israel, what access do they have to the normal services that you might see in most developed countries? I'm thinking about housing, education, health. What's the discrimination like for the Palestinians?
Sure. So the Palestinians in Israel, I mean, let's start with education. There are two complete separate education systems, one for Palestinians and one for Israeli Jews. And even Arab schools, the curriculum is dictated by the Israeli ministry. So, for instance, as a teacher, if you're a teacher in an Arab school and you teach Palestinian students, you're not allowed to talk about the Nakba. There are so many restrictions on how you teach history, civics, politics, In terms of infrastructure, for instance, if you look at Arab-Palestinian towns and villages who are predominantly based in the Jalil and the Galilee, for instance, there's no safe spaces or shelters in those villages that the Israeli government has built. So that means that they are more vulnerable in that sense, because even the system that kind of intercepts missiles and rockets is not designed to prioritize those areas in which Palestinians live. And that is why, if you think, you know, for instance, in 2006, with the war with Hezbollah and Israel, 50% of those who were killed from Hezbollah missiles were actually Palestinians. And that is because there's no infrastructure in Palestinian Arab towns and villages inside Israel to protect Palestinians, as opposed to, you know, Tel Aviv or other major Jewish cities.
We know the restrictions on Palestinians moving around the occupied territory or the West Bank. Is it similar in Israel?
No, it is not, because so Palestinians inside Israel are citizens, so they do have, I guess, the ability to move freely from one town to another, unlike Palestinians in the West Bank who could potentially move within the West Bank but cannot enter Israel or 1948 territories or Gaza. So there's a clear segregation, obviously, and a system in which Israel has built to kind of segregate but also divide Palestinians across. So you have Palestinians in Gaza, over 2 million Palestinians in Gaza who cannot leave Gaza, and no one can enter Gaza unless they're authorized by Israel. You have almost 3 million in the West Bank who can move within the West Bank but not to Gaza or 1948 Israel. And then you have 2 million Palestinians in Israel who cannot enter Gaza but could potentially also move within their territory.
Can they move to the West Bank?
Yes, they can, because effectively Israel controls the West Bank.
Right.
So as Israeli citizens, Israeli citizens, you know, Israeli cars with the Israeli license plates can move freely into the in and outside of the West Bank, potentially as well with Gaza, because if you think about it, de facto, Israel has annexed the entire Palestinian territory, but not just de facto annexation. We're also talking about de jure annexation, which Israeli leaders and politicians are trying to basically legally annex the West Bank. And this is a process that is underway. So it's just a matter of time for them to announce that as well.
Is there a segregated health system within Israel?
Look, segregation within Israel extends across all areas of life. If you look at how Palestinians or where Palestinians are located, so you would see that there are areas, towns and villages in which they live, and other areas they're not allowed to live in. For instance, there's some kibbutzes that they have specific committees to decide whether you're fit to live in those neighborhoods or towns. And by fit, they check whether you're culturally fit to live with them. And that means whether you're a Jewish person or not. The healthcare system there was some kind of increase in voices demanding that even hospitals segregate Palestinians from Jewish citizens. We hear that a lot across specifically the center-right faction of the Israeli society, where, you know, there was a big uproar because Israeli women who gave birth at hospitals, and then there was another Palestinian woman next to them, said that, they can't be in the same room together and they don't want to be sharing the same space as Palestinian women. So there's definitely systemic segregation, but also there's a societal one in which those kind of racist ideologies exist and mirror each other on a structural level, but also on a societal level.
And employment,
absolutely. Employment. I mean, there's some professions that are completely out of the question for Palestinians, including technology. Predominantly, the areas that are open for Palestinians are healthcare. And that's why you see there's a large proportion of Palestinian doctors and nurses, as well as teachers and educators, but not in the technology, which is obviously the highest paying sectors.
So there are some rights for Palestinians within Israel, but there's more areas where the segregation happens and outright discrimination.
There are some rights, not because Israel, again, it's important to remember that the Palestinians in Israel are indigenous people. So the Palestinians in Israel did not migrate to Israel. It's Israel that came and imposed itself on Palestinians in Israel. So their rights do not stem from the fact that Israel gives them quote-unquote rights, but the fact that they are indigenous to that land, that they were born on that land and so were their ancestors, and they have gone through and survived genocidal attempts, basically. So this is where their rights stem from, the fact that they are indigenous to their land and the fact that currently they are not receiving full or equal rights as Israeli citizens. It's important, this is the point that I think it's important to remind people, that even the fact that they are citizens, because Israel decided that, you know, in 1948 that 20% is fine, they can deal with, and then, you know, Israeli leaders such as Ben-Gurion and others thought that the old will die and the young will forget, and then we will have fully functioning Zionist society as well, including some of the assimilation. There was also a lot of attempts at assimilating the Palestinians specifically at the beginning, but that ended quite quickly because it just didn't work in Palestine. So it's important to just remind everyone that Palestinians in Israel do not enjoy equal rights as Israelis. They are indigenous to their land, and even though they are indigenous to that land, they don't enjoy equal rights as those settlers who migrated and colonized their land in 1947 and even before that.
What was the assimilation program and why did it fail?
The assimilation program basically sought to, and that was enacted through the education system, in which they used to teach Palestinian. And this is a part of, it's kind of ongoing, but initially after 1948, when Israel was established, and then there was a 20 years of military regime. So Palestinians in Israel lived under military regime, similar to what we have today in the West Bank. So they also needed permits to leave their towns and villages. And then the education system sought to teach Palestinians about, you know, obviously Zionism and the state of Israel as, you know, a new democracy that's going to give them rights. However, that failed because at its core, the Zionist project is an expansionist, Jewish supremacist project. So even those attempts at kind of presenting Zionism in Israel as a democracy failed because this is not on the ground. This is not what Israel did. What Israel did is that it continued to grab land from Palestinians who were Israeli citizens at that stage. So that's why we had Land Day events in which what we call the Land Day Triangle, Sakhnin, Arabi, and Deir Hanna, three major villages in the Galilee, staged mass strike and protest to protest the ongoing land confiscation policies of Israel and basically land grab. So Israel continued to basically ethnically cleanse Palestinians even within Israel after they became citizens.
There's no intermarriage between Jewish citizens of Israel and Palestinian citizens of Israel?
I think there are cases in which they do, but that is very, I guess, very minimal and very, very limited. It's not something that happens on a larger scale, and that is due to the fact that all Jewish Israelis have mandatory military service and therefore end up in a position where they carry weapon and direct it at Palestinians, Palestinian children. And it's important to keep in mind that this is by design. This is by design in the sense that to keep both communities and both people separate, this is how the system works. So that's why we have two separate education systems. That's why Palestinians and Israeli Jews live separately in separate villages and towns, so that it's easier for the state when people are 18 years old, to give them guns and rifles and say, now you go to the West Bank and shoot Palestinian children. So this indoctrination and the demonization, dehumanization of Palestinians starts from a very young age, which prevents any potential healthy relationship that could exist between Palestinians and Jewish Israelis in Israel.
Well, moving back to the current situation with the war between Israel and Iran, which is what it has become, with Iranian missiles landing in Israel, there is the Iron Dome. Can you explain why Palestinians say that the Iron Dome does not protect them?
Yeah, so the Iron Dome is really designed to prioritize rockets that fall on predominantly Jewish population in Israel. So, and that's how it just works. It just prioritizes those areas, which is another manifestation of apartheid in, you know, in Israel. It's, you know, Israel is like a genocidal nuclear state that is underpinned by an expansionist project of Jewish supremacy. So it does not see the Palestinians and Israel as a priority, but actually as a problem to get rid of. So the Israeli defense system, quote unquote, is not defending Palestinians, including the ones in Israel.
And they don't have the shelters. We see the photos of Jewish people going down into the shelters underground. The Palestinians don't have the same things?
No. So city councils, town halls and municipalities and authorities in Arab towns and villages inside Israel do not have the capacity to basically develop safe areas and shelters. And they don't have actually the budgets for that. And if most recently, there has been budget cuts by the infrastructure minister specifically going to these purposes. Again, this is, again, another reflection of how apartheid exists in 1948.
Is it true that the residents of Israel who have been killed and injured are actually Palestinians?
Yes, the of those who were killed recently by, you know, missiles from Iran are Palestinians. And that is due to the fact that there are no safe spaces in towns like Tamra in the Galilee, for instance, in the Galilee.
Going back to what you said right at the beginning, Noura, the people in Gaza, I'll just read one sentence. While Israel's war with Iran continues, Gazans are begging for help, saying their suffering is being ignored because of the new conflict.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the situation in Gaza continues, every day for the last 2 years. There's no doubt that the situation in Gaza is, you know, beyond words. Netanyahu clearly is stuck in Gaza with no clear exit strategy, but also there's no intention at, I think, exiting Gaza. I mean, they have been quite clear with their intention to annex and ethnically cleanse Palestinians in Gaza. And they have full support of their people as well, as I mentioned at the beginning, with 82% of the Israeli public supporting ethnically cleansing Gaza. Now, with the Israeli government also failing to achieve any of the declared objectives of the war genocide in Gaza that they stated early on, including, you know, retrieving the Israeli hostages or annihilating Hamas or exterminating Hamas any forms of military resistance 2 years later, and Netanyahu being perceived as the one who's responsible for the failure of October 7th internally. And now they're looking at, obviously, Iran, also with more unrealistic declared objectives that will could potentially lead to even more catastrophic results for the entire region and the entire world.
Finally, Noura, what could the Australian government do? What should the Australian government do? And what pressure is it on them to actually act?
Thank you. That's a great question, Jen. I think so. We can start by looking at what the Australian government did for the Ukraine. What did we do? What did the Australian government do to support Ukrainians? And why aren't they doing that now? It's important that when we talk about Gaza, once again, there are 2 million civilians who are trapped, being bombarded on a daily basis and starved. And this has been going on for 2 years with, you know, Israel enjoying full impunity. The fact is that Israel won't stop unless genuine pressure is applied on the Israeli government to end those war crimes and crimes against humanity. The Australian government should always be consistent with its support for international law and human rights. And it should be consistent with providing support for refugees who are fleeing as well. But above all, the Australian government must not be complicit and should end whatever support, be that militarily support, economic or political support, that they provide for the Israeli government. So arms embargo, that is the least we could do to ensure that, you know, we as Australian citizens are not also complicit in the ongoing genocide.
It must be very difficult as a Palestinian to watch this government, who probably many Palestinians would have voted for the Labor Party over the years, but it would be very difficult now to support this Labor Party, who seems to have rejected the Palestinians.
Yes, it's quite disappointing and it's quite heartbreaking to see that this government has decided to basically throw the Palestinian people under the bus. Mind you, the Palestinians have never really caused harm or invaded anyone's territory, or in that sense, they're just people who exist on their land and just want to survive and have normal lives on their ancestral land. And it's really heartbreaking to see that our government continues with its complicity and also ambiguity and refusing to actually end the support that they provide to the Israeli government.
Thank you, Noura.
No worries, Jan.
I've been speaking with Noura Mansour, National Director of Democracy in Colour, educator and political analyst.
3CR, your station, your voice.
Palestine is not just the land of the Muslims. It's the land of three people and all people. The land of the Muslims, the land of the Christians, and the land of the Jews who are decent and not Zionist Jews. When we say from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, that does not mean that we are going to get rid of the Jews from that land. We are saying there is going to be one state of Palestine, the historic Palestine, where the Jews and the Christians and the Muslims can live side by side peacefully.
3CR, your station, your voice.
This is for Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take it to...
Get involved in the End of Financial Year Week of Action from June 23 to June 27 across Naarm, Melbourne. For this end of financial year, join us for a week of action, protests, film nights, banner drops and more, calling out this illegal Australian regime's economic ties to genocide, from the stolen wealth on this continent to funding Israel's war machine as they annihilate Gaza and attack Iran. Take action. Organise your own. Show up. Follow FreePalestineCoalition.naam on Instagram or visit FreePalestineCoalitionNaam.com. Cut all ties to genocide at the end of financial year, week of action from June 23 to June 27. Free Palestine Coalition NAM is a 3CR supporter.
Free, free Palestine, 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 free, free Palestine.
Stop Netanyahu before he gets us all killed. We could soon see nuclear powers pitted against each other and dragging the world closer to nuclear annihilation. They're just some comments relating to the Israeli preemptive strike launched on Iran on the 13th of June. On Saturday, I spoke with senior lecturer at RMIT, Binoy Kantmark, and asked him to concentrate first on Netanyahu, where he comes from, and what are his ambitions for Israel.
Well, I mean, Netanyahu is one of those individuals who's a chameleon of politics. He's managed to adjust his positions. You have to remember, he's been around as essentially, if you can think of a comparison, the other statesman or leader, I suppose, that's equivalent in terms of sheer durability and length of stay in office is Vladimir Putin himself. In fact, they're sort of near contemporaries in that sense. Came to power around the same time, and of course, the difference that with Netanyahu has been more staggered, more interrupted, but still very much a feature of Israeli policy. And he has been, of course, essentially a bane to the peace process. There's not a peace process to speak of. He's never been interested in forging a two-state solution, whatever he might have said at points to kudos in Washington or whichever power it might have been at the time. He has a loathing for Palestinians that's almost verging on visceral at points. And actually, it may also stem from the fact that his brother actually perished. The only casualties the Israelis suffered in the raid on Entebbe. So I do actually think it goes right back to that instinctive hatred he has for the Palestinians. There is that, but there is also the fact that he has made no secret of the fact that Israel needs to maintain its primacy, its power in the local area. Of course, it's making sure the Palestinians are subjugated, making sure they're divided. You know, let's not forget, this is the same man who openly encouraged the funding of Hamas for years. So he actually gave a speech at a Likud gathering, which was the details of which were leaked some years ago, where he was justifying why Qatari money would be facilitated to fund Hamas. And he was very open about that. He actually said, this is a good idea. This is a good thing to do. Because it keeps the Palestinian cause divided, because Hamas is, of course, the outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood, the movement from Egypt, developed in the 1980s as a response. It's part of the first intifada against Israeli occupation in Gaza. Hamas is, of course, an enemy of Fatah, which is the rival faction in the West Bank, which is the faction connected with Yasser Arafat, the PLO, and the Palestinian authorities in West Bank. So anyway, that really came unstuck, of course, on October 7th, 2023, when the very same body that had been assisted by Israel, that had been essentially blessed with Israel's backing in order to divide the Palestinian cause, that sort of came back to bite them dramatically, as we know, with the attacks on Israel facilitated by Hamas's militia wing, and other aiding militias and so on. So anyway, that brings us then to the situation we see now, where he's also got a broader international perspective beyond that, which is to make sure that no country in the Middle East, especially Iran, this is a fixation of his for a long time, shall acquire nuclear weapons. And it is his goal. It's been a fixation of his for years. And what we saw starting on, depending on which time zone you're on, you know, June the 12th, June 13th, the attacks on Iran, which commenced essentially something that he's wanted to do for years.
Go back years to his time in America, the United States, who he met and who he worked with. What's the influence of that on his thinking?
Very influential, yes. He was very significant a figure in the neocon establishment, so he knew all the individuals associated with the project for the New American Century. He knew all the individuals connected with who would ultimately find themselves in the Bush administration. This is George W. Bush, the hawks like Rumsfeld and so forth. So he knew all of those characters fairly well. Ultimately, these individuals also shaped this so-called, as disingenuous as I always thought it, this democratization of the Middle East project, which is something that he has been nursing for some time. Of course, not that Israel itself would be capable or have the means, let alone the interest, in democratizing the Middle East, but there would be destabilizing regimes in the Middle East in such a way that would result in regime change and so on. And that's exactly, of course, what we're essentially seeing. You know, the mission of attacking Iran is sort of morphed into a mission of regime change. But then again, I always suspected that this is exactly the idea. The idea is to create as much mayhem as possible, So it's very much similar to the other neocon project, which is, of course, that of the toppling of Saddam Hussein in 2003 by the U.S.-led operation there. And it's the echoes are very similar. The neocon echoes are very, very similar in terms of overthrowing a regime on very flimsy premises, you know, the inevitability of acquiring or having certain weapons of mass destruction, the capacity to make them, and imminent use. This is the other thing, too, all this nonsense about the imminent danger that other people, including Israel, are supposedly going to feel. So we see all of that unfolding. So there are all these echoes that stretch back to Netanyahu's time, when he was cutting his teeth in U.S. politics or in the background. And, of course, when he went back to Israel, he managed to bring all of that, his connections as well, his links. He's very much an Americanized Israeli in that sense. You can tell from the way he speaks, from his manner, unlike some of the other Israeli characters, Israeli leaders. This is a man who's very much connected with the U.S. establishment.
So is the U.S. running Israel, or is Israel running the U.S.?
Oh, yeah, I think it's the other way around. I think it's Israel having a huge influence in the United States.
But why?
Yeah, and it's a huge thing, and they've invested a huge amount in sponsorship, in lobbying members of Congress, and also, of course, linking interests with, which is not necessarily something that one would have thought a very healthy thing, which is trying to cultivate the evangelicals in the United States, because the evangelicals in the United States, which is that huge block of votes that usually the Republicans need to cultivate, which was done during the Reagan administration, the two Reagan administrations in the 80s, the Billy Grahams and so on and so on. I mean, they needed to cultivate that bloc. And a strange alliance was developed between that and Israel's safety and Israel's security. That links the United States as well with Israeli security as well, because the idea being that where there is Armageddon, when the truths will be revealed and so on and so forth, and then the final confrontations between the good forces of good and evil will see that manifestation in Israel. And that's the reason why the evangelicals are still thrilled. Mind you, when push comes to shove, their cynicism, as in the evangelicals, is such that the Jews are going to take second place because the Christians will take first place. But that sort of is left a bit to the side. But so the link between the evangelicals, the incredible lobbying heft that the Israeli groupings have in the United States, especially in Washington, on the Hill, and so on, the link in from a security standpoint between the so-called, only democracy in the Middle East as a kind of a factor that counterbalances the authoritarian regimes and in the rest of the Gulf area, also in North Africa and so on. So all of that plays into this bizarre, very dangerous influence that the Israelis do have on U.S. policy.
So are the evangelicals the Christian Zionists, or is that something again?
Only in a tactical sense, or in a strategic sense, should I say, because they're tactical situational Zionists. They're happy to back Israel because Israel is a means to an end. It's like they need the holy sites to be intact. They need the territory to be intact because that's where the apocalypse, this eschatological idea that finally the forces of light will triumph over the forces of darkness, that will happen in Israel. And so this is why this is such a dangerous thing when you see the instability in the region, because the political backdrop of this has always been one that is driven in these doomsday-like scenarios. And that's why it's really quite dangerous.
Apart from the United States, you've got Western countries such as France, Germany, England, in Europe. You've got Australia around here. Is it still the guilt of the Holocaust, or is it more than that?
Well, some years ago, this phrase was coined, called the shadow of the Holocaust. And it's a couple of scholars have mentioned this over the years. And I think it's a very powerful image. And that is, it's linked to that guilt. It is the idea that policy is done in the shadow of the Holocaust, and the guilt aspect is manipulated and milked, you know, because it's a great incentive. You know, the making of policy, Israeli subjugation of the Palestinians, and the excuse that they are incapable of committing genocide. I mean, you can even see that in the submissions in the International Court of Justice, where it was more or less suggested that Israel was incapable of committing genocide because we are you know, a testament to the survival from the Holocaust. You know, the Nazi Germany tried to destroy us. We survived, and this, the great embodiment of Israel, is testament to that fact. So what we're doing is self-defense. Everything is self-defense. So that policy is very much something that is milked on. It's been very convincing, for example, for the German, especially the German, which is understandable in many ways, given the historical legacy there. But the Israelis have been making use of that to the hilt, making use of German guilt, which is why German foreign policy on Israel is, even after the horrendous campaign of the IDF in Gaza, even now it's very difficult to be critical of Israel in Germany, because there is this element that the operations conducted by the Israelis is done in self-defense, as fatuous as that is.
And also the fact that anyone in the Western countries are targeted now if they put their head up in any way as being pro-Palestinian. Would you have expected something like that to happen? Even people being jailed?
Yeah, well, this is, of course, the remarkable thing, how far that's gone. And it's quite shocking to see that the whole notions of freedom of expression have been put right to the side when it comes to a lot of these things, the you know, with pro-Palestinian protests, and the whole notion that there is some kind of stampeding, monstrous anti-Semitism going on. I mean, look, there's no question that there is a sentiment of anti-Israeli business going on, you know, but that people should distinguish between that and the notion of not liking Jews. Admittedly, of course, there's the anti-Semitic streak is always there in some parts, but the extent of what is supposedly there has been so exaggerated that it's become a campaign, especially in the States, for example, the Trump administration, against universities, targeting institutions like Harvard, for example, for supposedly being anti-Semitic and supposedly not doing enough to crack down on pro-Palestinian supporters. And we've also seen, and this is something that I've been looking at closely, the ongoing campaign in Australia by universities to expel and to target students who are pro-Palestinian protesters. You know, they've made a special point. Several students have been, you know, expelled, for example, from the Australian National University. But thankfully, some of these instances have been overturned on appeal. So we see that across the board. Yes, the moment you associate with the idea of defending Palestinians and talking about the crimes in Gaza, the establishment then says, "Well, no, you're anti-Semitic. You know, you're dangerous. You're denying Israel's right to exist," you know, which is of course nonsensical in the scheme of things. But those are the things you face, and it is very trying times, actually, if you want to express debate and opinions on this.
Well, moving on to Iran and the comment, "Stop Netanyahu before he gets us all killed."
Yes, this is it, isn't it? The whole business of the conflict with Iran, which is now, again, Netanyahu likes gambits. He likes gambles. He takes gambles and causes. And this is something that he's wanted to do for a very long time, which is to knock out any prospect of an Iranian nuclear program. Doesn't matter, civilian or otherwise. In his view, it doesn't matter. He will say anything, he will confect anything, he will do anything in order to make sure that the Iranians do not acquire a nuclear facility. And what he's done here is this, and this is always the danger, is that somehow these things can be contained. And we're seeing now how utterly absurd that is, because with each day, the longer it goes on, and given the fact that the mullahs, you know, they themselves, you know, have their bloodlust and so on, and they themselves are particularly keen. You know, we saw that during the context of the Iran-Iraq war, when the Ayatollah Khomeini was zealous in essentially sending Iranians to their deaths in fighting Saddam Hussein. Admittedly, the Iraqis were the ones who invaded. Let's face the facts. But the war was unnecessarily dragged on for years longer than it needed to because of prevarication on Iran's part. And even when Iran, under the Ayatollah Khomeini, had already gained an advantage in more or less humiliating the Iraqis, and certainly up to the midpoint of the war kept going on because the Iranians got so enthusiastic. Let's not forget, Iraq has a very large Shia population. Iranians were thinking that this could be cultivated, and so that's why they prolonged the conflict. So I don't see calls and threats of let's talk now, let's go to the diplomatic table, the ridiculous intervention of the EU telling Iran that Iran has to go to the diplomatic table. What about Israel, for goodness sake? You know, and so on. Well, no, it's Iran. Iran is the one that's blamed. Iran is the one that's seen as the perversely. Iran can't exercise its right to self-defense, but Israel can. And this is this kind of hypocrisy that we're seeing. So the upshot of it is, yes, Netanyahu is now embarked on this. We can't, I certainly can't see it ebbing too soon. The Israelis are hoping that the Americans, the United States, will get involved, especially to wipe out the remaining Fardo facility, which is deep on the ground. And supposedly the talk now, and this is why Trump is umming and ahhing, having given himself a two-week period of mulling over things. But the U.S. have been deploying jets to the region. They've been deploying military assets, and it seems to be that the possibility that they might join in to attack the facilities too, and that, of course, would be absolutely catastrophic.
Where does Russia fit in?
Well, Russia is an odd one in this because, of course, Russia is an ally of Iran, both of them have had interests in the Middle East, certainly with Russia's intervention in the Syrian civil war. People can debate civil or not, but anyway, the fact is that Russia was backing the Assad regime, and Russia's involvement also signaled Iran's involvement, and Iran supplied, of course, various Shia groups fighting the various other militant groups in the region, including ISIS, of course, and including the rebel groups. So they've been tied together, and also by virtue of the fact that both of them have a heavy sanctions regime placed on them by various Western countries, and they've been obviously growing closer from a security perspective, but also from an economic perspective. So that leads to the issue of, yes, the issue of Russian interests, and Putin has ventured out, put some feelers out about trying to get people to talk and trying to restrain things. But I'm not entirely convinced that he will necessarily have much heft in this. I mean, I could be wrong. Maybe in the background something is happening. I think a lot of this at this point is trying to urge restraint on the part of the United States not to be involved. I wouldn't rule it out that Putin is and has engaged maybe in conversations with Trump or through diplomatic calls about restraint in that regard and trying to get the parties to sort of limit the extent of the damage. But that's the situation, the way I see it there.
Well, Trump's on the nose with a majority of the people in America now. How would him getting more involved in this war impact at home?
Well, this is fascinating from the perspective that We need to draw a distinction here about, you know, who would be interested in going in and engaging the Iranians. This is as in sending U.S. forces in, be they aerial or be they sort of even ground and whatnot. Trump made it his signature policy to end the so-called never-ending wars that the United States had been engaged in, including, of course, the quagmire of the Middle East, Afghanistan, Iraq, and so on. So his MAGA base is very importantly, overwhelmingly against intervention. But funnily enough, many Democrats are very much for it. So it's a very perverse thing we see where many Democrats they actually have become in many ways the warring party, you know, the party that favors overthrowing governments because they don't like them or whatever it might be. So even though they loathe Trump and there is a large base there, the thing to look out for is the MAGA base because people like Steve Bannon, people like Tucker Carlson, these individuals who are the ideologues of the movement, they are very worried about it, and they constantly speak out against any U.S. intervention. And there was a very fascinating interview that Tucker Carlson did with, and for those of you who haven't heard of Tucker Carlson, of course, former Fox News anchor and shock jock, for want of a better term, and in an interview that he did with Senator Ted Cruz, it got an incredibly heated because Carlson was more or less ridiculing Cruz's lack of knowledge about the ethnic constituents in Iran, the instability that an attack would cause, if there's regime change, the kind of chaos that would result. And Cruz, of course, was essentially parroting the neocon lines about needing to overthrow a regime. Well, this regime is dangerous. We need to overthrow it. So why not be involved? So we see that division very much within it. I think a poll was done recently. Only one in five are in favor of intervention using U.S. troops and U.S. Personnel. That's remarkable, actually. So the movement itself, it risks dividing and risks facing a conflict, and that's something to keep an eye on.
The situation for the people of Gaza and increasingly the West Bank and East Jerusalem, the brutality of the Israelis started to make the front pages just recently, but with this going on with Iran, they're back on the back pages, it would seem.
Yes, this is the other thing. And of course, it's part of the cynicism of Netanyahu as well. The man's the wells of cynicism coming from that man are boundless. I mean, they're depthless. It's extraordinary. So by doing this, of course, it is a very nice distraction as to what's happening. And what's shocking is that the death toll now is as high as it has been at any point of Israeli operations. Let's face it, the number of Israeli personnel, security personnel, troops and whatnot in Gaza is considerable at this point. The death toll amongst them is rising. And this is something that's not mentioned very much, too, but their casualty list is growing there, too, because of the old techniques of guerrilla techniques, of booby traps and demolition of sites. And so when Israeli troops go into a building, not that there's much to destroy anymore, most of it is leveled as it is, but they still, when they're trying to find Hamas militants, they end up being ambushed. But the death toll on Palestinians, just overnight, for example, in the last 24 hours, something like 144 Palestinians in Gaza were killed. It's staggering. It's shocking. And of course, now that Israel has bypassed the UN with providing aid through its very dubiously sponsored Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, very strange outfit that was established and founded in Switzerland, which tells you all you need to know about transparency, about, you know, its origins, and the private security firm that works with them. What they've done essentially is create the most shocking circumstances of limited humanitarian aid. On a daily basis, Palestinians seeking aid are being shot at. Just a few days ago, Israeli forces went so far as to shell Palestinians seeking aid. And that's how appalling it's become. So that part of it is, if anything, it's getting more severe. But as you rightly point out, it's assumed the back pages because everyone, at least in the Western media context, is focusing on Iran and Israel.
Is it an issue, Binoy, of the number of Jewish people coming from overseas to fight with the IDF? I would call them mercenaries, but they wouldn't. Is that an issue at all?
Well, in a sense, it's always been an issue insofar as individuals, we see it in the Australian context. We've seen Australian citizens who are dual nationals, but also, so they are also Israeli nationals, but they're Australians who go and they serve in the IDF. I would have thought that that would be problematic from the Australian policy perspective, but it seems that if you fight for Israel, this is a jolly good thing. If you were to do the same thing, fighting for Iran, that would be probably a very bad thing. So there is this double standard very much in play. But yes, this diaspora is absolutely one thing that the Israelis have been very conscious with exploiting. From the patriotic or the nationalist perspective, you know, get people in, especially from the United States, of course. There was a very large, as you have noticed, you would have noticed a very large number of U.S.-educated Israeli citizens who are participating in this, but also those in the United States wanting to serve in the IDF. So you certainly see elements of that.
Well, I'm sure I'll talk to you about this in the near future, Binoy.
Yes, I'm afraid this is not going away, Jan, and I think it's something that, unfortunately, with all its grimness and its appalling realities, it needs to be discussed, of course. But it is absolutely extraordinary what we're seeing in real time, and this is the shocking thing. So what we're seeing in Gaza is literally an experiment of annihilation and dispossession and leveling in real time, and this is what's so utterly extraordinary, and it's happening as we speak.
Thank you, Binoy.
Thank you, Jan. Anytime.
And Binoy Campmark is a senior lecturer at RMIT University. And that interview with Binoy Campmark was recorded 24 hours before the US bombed Iran. I'm hoping that I'll be able to speak to Binoy again in a week's time to get some more information from him of how he's looking at the situation now that America has gone to Iran.
Public transport's great.
What's not great is that unless you've got a radio with you, you can't listen to 3CR when you're on it.
Until now. The Community Radio Plus app lets you listen to us wherever you are.
Get on board and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
Every day at the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, people who have fled persecution arrive at our doorstep in search of safety. Your tax-deductible gift today can help provide urgent essentials like food, housing, healthcare and mental health support so people seeking asylum can begin to heal and rebuild. Please give to the ASRC's Winter Appeal today to offer dignity and hope to refugees and people seeking asylum. Donate today at asrc.org.au/donate. The Asylum Seeker Resource Centre is a 3CR supporter.
Prime Minister Albanese is not shy in repeating that Australia has entered a new era for our defence. We make our own decisions, re-defence, insisting Australia will remain sovereign, particularly with the AUKUS deal. And replying to Trump's demands for Australia to ratchet up its defence policy, Australia already pulls its weight. But many analysts and others question Australia's objective capacity to determine its own defence and intelligence requirements, instead being heavily influenced by the US interests and perspectives. Richard Bronoska, AO, is a former Australian diplomat, General Manager of Radio Australia, adjunct professor at the Universities of Canberra and Sydney, and an author. In an article in Pearls and Irritations, his belief is that Australia's defence and intelligence agencies are US outposts. I spoke to Richard last Friday. And Richard, before we look at the situation post-World War II and the US, what was the defence and intelligence relationship with Britain, both prior to and during World War II?
We relied strongly on the British intelligence. In fact, as you know, we didn't even have a diplomatic service until the beginning of the Second World War, really. We relied on Whitehall to tell us what was what. We identified with British interests in the what they call the Far East, our near north. We regarded Singapore as a bastion of protection against the downward thrust of Japan. And yes, we were very dependent on the British. We took what they considered to be the situation in the world for granted. We just accepted what they said.
So the Americans, we think about it as after World War II, but it was actually during World War II.
Well, yes, as I said in my article, the Brenchley Park communications base in Britain, which was decoding German signals, was the beginning of an alliance between the United States and Britain with intelligence. And then Canada joined later, and then Australia and New Zealand did as well. So it became known as the Five Eyes. And we had about four or five intelligence organisations in Australia all linked into this. And the Brits did, and the Canadians did, and New Zealand did as well. So it was a sort of a jolly club to share intelligence and communications. But the fact was that the Americans were predominant very much in that after the Second World War, because they're the ones who really decided that there was an ineluctable downward thrust by Russian communism, and that had infected and taken over China, and China wanted to take over the rest of Southeast Asia. Bob Menzies was the leading proponent of that in Australia, but everyone fell in line with him. So it was really the American view that we accepted wholeheartedly and agreed ourselves was the threat to Australia from communism.
And we've paid a heavy price, haven't we, over the years for our subservience?
Yes, we have. I almost included Korea as a country which we were also colonised by the United States, but that's not quite true. Korea was, I think, a separate case from Vietnam and the others in that it was an international United Nations peacekeeping force that went in there to try to frustrate the downward thrust of North Korean communism into South Korea, although it was the Americans who divided the country in the first place without any attempt to refer to the Korean people. They just did it and put Pyongyang in the north and Seoul in the south. And ever since then, we've had troubles in Korea. We still do.
Well, talk about Vietnam. That goes back a long way now, doesn't it? But the repercussions are still there.
We were convinced that the war was in fact an externally directed one from China, with Russia in the background, and that they were supplying weapons and equipment to North Vietnam. Remember, the French fought the Civil War after they came back at the end of the Second World War, and they tried to recapture the whole of their colony of Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam, and they didn't succeed. Dien Bien Phu in 1954 was the end of French colonial exploitation in Southeast Asia. So Ho Chi Minh took over the north. He wasn't allowed to go to the south. The Americans divided the country. So the south became a sort of a satrap for the United States. We went along with the thinking that it was always an outward attack on South Vietnam, which was a neat little democratic country, but it wasn't that at all. It was very much a colony, very much under the sway of the United States.
And, of course, it didn't just affect Vietnam. It was the surrounding countries as well.
Oh, of course. There were communists in Laos and Cambodia, Khmer Rouge, who turned into a terrible outfit under Pol Pot, enormous amounts of murder. Yeah, it was the whole of the former French colonial Southeast Asian empire.
And then we move on to Iraq and Afghanistan. And again, America's goes into these countries without much thought, I would imagine, to what's going to happen at the end of these wars.
Well, there's a lot of thinking about it, Jan. But Bush convinced himself that the World Trade Center in 1901 had been attacked by Afghanistani forces led by al-Qaeda, and he convinced himself that Afghanistan should be invaded by American forces. Australia, of course, John Howard, went along with this 100%, and he agreed and sent troops into Afghanistan as well. And the irony was that most of the perpetrators were Saudi Arabians of the World Trade Center attack, with one Egyptian and I think one other Arab as well. It was a false intelligence. We went along with it. And John Howard has never admitted that he made a mistake, never.
But what I meant was that they don't seem to have an understanding of what it's going to be if and when that war ends.
What, the war in, which war are we talking about? Afghanistan?
Iraq, Afghanistan.
We've left devastated countries. Iraq is a basket case now. Its civil structure has been destroyed. Afghanistan is the same. Women have a terrible time in Afghanistan as they did before. It was an American defeat. The Americans got out precipitously, and we did too. We simply follow the Americans in what they do. And that's why I say that Australian intelligence services, intelligent they are in their own right, a lot of competent, good people there, but they're colonised by American thinking and continue to be. What's going on in the Middle East now? Let's wait to see which way Donald Trump jumps. At least Albanese is beginning to show a bit of spirit and condemning Israeli attacks in Gaza. And I hope he roundly condemns Israel for attacking Iran as well. Let's wait and see what happens there. It's a very fraught situation. It's very dangerous.
Just go back a little, Richard. You're a diplomat for many years in different countries around the world. What was it like for you working in those countries where there were conflicts around the places? You were in Latin America. How was it for you as a as a diplomat?
I had a lot of bilateral issues to worry about. I mean, when I went to Vietnam, I was Labor's first ambassador to go into United Vietnam with my embassy in Hanoi in 1983. Bill Hayden gave me four jobs: start an aid program, start a trade program, finish all the unfinished business of the war, like having a missing in action mission and the Royal Commission to Agent Orange and handing back our property in Saigon, and also finding out what Vietnam was doing in Cambodia, which they'd invaded on Christmas Day 1979, and when they're going to get out. So I had a menu there, and all this was laid out. And Bill Hayden was a man of integrity and very much following and fortifying Australia's own national interests. For example, the United States, along with China and Southeast Asian countries, continued to recognise Pol Pot after Vietnam had chucked him out, the murderer. And we did too, until I introduced Bill Hayden to Hun Sen, the so-called satrap or puppet leader in Cambodia that Vietnam had put in place. And Bill met him and had a long talk to him and convinced himself that Hun Sen was not a puppet of Vietnam. He was a genuine Cambodian patriot. And so we changed our vote. And the Americans were horrified by that. They were very scathing. But we did it, and we went ahead with our building our bilateral relations with Vietnam. So that's one example where we defied United States thinking and went our own way.
What about your role in Latin America?
Well, I was ambassador to Mexico with joint accreditation to all the Central American republics and Cuba as well. With Mexico, it was mainly trade. It had a lot to do with, you know, promoting Australian cattle sales to Mexico and factories we had in the northern border of Mexico, supplying the auto industry, a lot of bilateral exchanges. But the interesting case was Cuba. I was ambassador to Cuba, and I met Fidel Castro on a number of occasions, and Hugh Morgan of Western Mining was attempting to start a nickel mine in Fidel's own province, and I helped facilitate those negotiations. They didn't amount to anything in the long run, because I think Hugh felt that the Cubans simply didn't understand Western business practices. Anyway, I was quite concerned when Australia was really bound by the United States in what we did in Cuba. For example, a sugar milling company in Queensland was selling equipment to Cuba for their sugar industry, until the company was taken over by an American company and therefore fell under the American trade embargo with Cuba and had to stop dealing with them. And when I went into Cuba, there was a British European trade mission there trading away with Cuba, and we should have done the same thing, instead of which we're being restricted by American thinking.
Did you have any roles in either Western or Eastern Europe?
No, not really, not at all. I mean, when in Iran, I was tangentially involved in thinking about Eastern Europe to some extent. But no, I've never had a European posting, Jan. And I regret that. It would have been good to have done that, but I didn't.
And further east to China?
No, I was in Japan and Korea, of course, as ambassador. So again, at the margins, I had a lot to do with what the Chinese were doing in the region, but not from Beijing itself. I didn't learn Chinese at all.
What are your thoughts on Taiwan at the moment and the push by the US to involve Australia in a war with China?
Well, some in the United States would do that, others would not. I mean, in Washington itself, there is division about whether to defend Taiwan against China or not. I think the thinking outside the Trump envelope is that it would be foolish for America to involve itself in a war with China over Taiwan, because most American intelligence organizations and the military itself realize that if there was a war with China, America would probably lose. Why? Because although they've got a vast Pacific fleet, they'd be fighting a distant war. They'd have to go towards China, whereas the Chinese are fighting in their own front yard. They're defending their own territory. And the Chinese, as everyone now knows, has developed an extremely sophisticated military force. They're also very, very powerful and very strong, and they have strong memories about how China was humiliated in the 19th century by the open door policy, when every European power of any worth and the United States had colonies in China itself. I mean, the Opium Wars were started by Britain to try to get the Chinese to take the drug, and it was a great financial benefit to the British, and that was disgraceful.
Well, moving on to Iran, and can we have a little bit of history as you see the recent history of Iran?
If you're talking about nuclear matters, let me say the Shah, who was head of, as we know, a dictatorial head of Iran right up until he left in 1979, the Shah wanted nuclear power. He had one Russian-designed reactor at Bushehr at the head of the Persian Gulf, but he wanted a series of power stations right along the Persian Gulf. I don't think he had, at that stage, in mind developing nuclear weapons. He was paranoid about the Russians coming down through Iran to establish warm water ports in the Persian Gulf, but I don't think he really had a push to develop nuclear weapons. And when the Ayatollah took over, Ayatollah Khomeini, and it became a theocracy, a Muslim theocracy, they also said, we don't want nuclear weapons. In fact, there was a fatwa declared by Ayatollah Khomeini against, Khamenei, I think, his successor, against Iran developing nuclear weapons. They certainly wanted nuclear power. But the silly thing is, Jan, that the European Union and China and Russia and the United States worked very hard to develop the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with Iran's approval in 2015, under which the Iranians agreed to get rid of all their highly enriched uranium, close down a number of their other plants, and send their irradiated uranium from the Bushehr reactor to Russia for reprocessing, so they couldn't turn it into bombs. And all this they did, in that they had the most comprehensive IAEA safeguards regime with Iran that the International Atomic Energy Agency enjoyed with any country. And Trump comes in 2018 and says this is not good enough and walked away from it. So the Iranians simply shrugged their shoulders and went ahead with their program, unfettered by the restraints they had agreed to before.
What do you believe is happening in Iran today regarding weapons?
I think this is a constant lie, a deliberate lie by the Israeli government, led by Netanyahu, to say that the Iranians are on the cusp of having nuclear weapons. He's been saying that. They've been saying that ever since almost the beginning of the 21st century. And it's just not true. And the CIA does an annual report on what is happening in Iran, and has never, right up to today, said that the Iranians are developing nuclear weapons. They haven't done that. I think it's a myth that has allowed Israel to put pressure on Trump to go in and attack Iran, and it's an extremely dangerous situation. And when you realise that Iran is a country of no little power and a great historical heritage, a country that is surrounded by six nuclear-aimed countries, India and Pakistan, Israel, Russia, and the United States Fifth Fleet in the Persian Gulf. And why should they not have their own nuclear deterrent? The Israelis perpetrate the myth that once the Iranians develop a bomb, they'll simply drop it on Jerusalem or one on Tel Aviv. Why would they do such a thing? They want a deterrent like any other country. And if they did that, of course, they'd be wiped out with nuclear weapons from Israel, who's never admitted to having them themselves, but of course they do.
It seems to me, and I'd imagine to some other people, that Israel is just wiping out its opponents one by one. We've got wars against Lebanon, we've had wars against Syria, Iraq, and now we have Iran. How does Israel do it? Where are all these weapons coming from? People say, oh, well, that they produce their own weapons, but there must be an awful lot of American weapons being shipped into Israel to allow it to continue these wars, and particularly against the Palestinian people.
Well, firstly, Jan, the Israelis developed in secret their own nuclear weapons capability. They stole French equipment and technology. It's always been very closely guarded, and they developed their own nuclear force, and they have, I don't know how many weapons now, but a number, quite a number. Conventionally, it's been a weapons industry country. They develop their own munitions. They can service their own aircraft. But mainly their equipment, other than nuclear, comes from the United States. These weapons that have been devastating and killing Gazans are from the United States. The US, despite its wringing its hands and saying, oh, you shouldn't be doing what you're doing, they keep supplying weapons to Israel. So it's a completely hypocritical situation on the part of the United States, in my view.
And, of course, the hypocrisy is that they're trying to destroy Iran because they say they're developing nuclear weapons. But we remember Mordecai Vanunu, what he exposed all those years ago.
Yeah, well, as I said before, I think the United States is behind the whole thing. There was a regime under George W. Bush and before him of senior bureaucrats in Washington who had a plan to get rid of a number of Middle East country regimes, seven Middle East countries, and turn them into what they wanted were democracies. Of course, that didn't happen. And Iran is the last one. I mean, they've done Libya, they've done Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia. So, you know, Iran is the last one to go. That has been a long-term plan of right-wing organizers in the United States. Whether they succeed in Iran is a very, very dangerous situation. And my bet is the Iranians are going to stand up to them. And I just hope, against hope, that Trump is not foolish enough to join Israel in bombarding Iran.
Well, it takes us right back to the beginning, Richard, and Australia's connections or subservient to the US. Do you believe Albanese is silly enough to send Australian troops or more Australian weapons to Israel?
Oh, no, I don't think he'd do that. No, certainly not. But he might. He has been forced into a situation through the rather foolish policies of Richard Marles to get involved in a war with China if the Americans decide to defend Taiwan. The whole AUKUS deal puts us in that position. If we acquire nuclear-propelled submarines, the Virginia-class from the United States, we would be expected that they would join a force to attack China. My view, and I expressed this in the article you referred to, is that we should go back to the French and consider them, along with other very sophisticated submarine manufacturing companies in Korea and Japan and Germany and Sweden, and just look again at the whole situation. We don't need nuclear-propelled submarines. We need shallow water submarines around our northern coastline and elsewhere to defend Australia. We don't want to be forced into joining the United States in an attack with nuclear-powered submarines against China.
And we have to look after our major trading partner, China, and not keep on threatening to join with the United States in pushing.
Up until a couple of years ago, we had good relations with China. It's very sad to see how it has deteriorated, beginning with Malcolm Turnbull's decision not to allow Huawei to come into Australia. I think he regrets that now. But it seems to me that the ball is in our court to continue to develop negotiations, keep open lines of communications with Beijing. And if we do that and keep away from agreeing and declaring to the United States that we will not join them in a war against China, that's the best course we can have. And it's hard to see whether that's going to happen, but that is my hope.
Well, we've got Anthony Albanese, we've got Penny Wong, we've got Richard Miles, very different people, but we can only hope that they make the right decision.
Yes, that's right. And I think Penny Wong is a highly intelligent and balanced woman. She's been wedged, though, like all of the Labor Party, by the right wing and the Liberal Party and the Murdoch press. It's just unconscionable the way this is going.
And if you had any decision-making power now, what would you be telling them?
I'd be telling Washington we're not going to join you in a war against China if you decide to do that. I'd be telling Washington we don't want your nuclear-propelled submarines, thank you very much. Go back to look at our options in that regard. We do need submarines, conventionally driven submarines, to protect Australia, along with a whole lot of other equipment. Drones is the latest thing. We need to reconsider the whole traditional way in which the Army, Navy and Air Force are armed. I think this is taking place. Hugh White gave a very good speech in Sydney the other day, the ANU academic, saying that, there is new thinking developing. And I put to him the question, well, is that penetrating the halls of Canberra? And he really didn't know, but it doesn't seem it has so yet. And it seems to me that Deputy Prime Minister and Minister to Defence Richard Marles continues to hold sway over this mythological and highly dangerous idea that Australia needs American Virginia-class nuclear-propelled submarines.
Do we need to look at the background of Richard Marles, where he's got to the position he is now?
Well, it's a very conventional background. I think he went to a very senior leading private boys' school in Melbourne. He's had a conventional upbringing. He's no doubt got many good qualities, but to my mind, he's got a very foolish idea about how Australia should defend itself, and I think a very wrong conviction and support for this AUKUS understanding and arrangement. It's not in Australia's national interest to have it.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Richard.
Well, thanks, Jan. Always a pleasure.
I've been speaking to former diplomat Richard Brynoska. And Richard was speaking to me on Friday.
3CR Radiothon 2025, your station, your voice.
So we already know the harms of Australia's offshore detention regime, and yet instead of closing down that offshore processing regime, the Albanese government is seeking to expand it.
3CR, your station, your voice.
Make your donation during our annual Radiothon. It's your station, your voice.
To donate, call 0394198377 or go online at 3cr.org.au.
And to conclude the program, I'm speaking with Bob Phelps, the Executive Officer of the Gene Ethics Network. And Bob, Monash IVF, in the news for all the wrong reasons, but we never hear IVF being referred to as what it is, genetic engineering.
No, indeed. And of course, it's now a global and multi-billion dollar industry, and it's really poorly regulated. The hands-off position of people like the National Health and Medical Research Council is quite unsatisfactory, because it was sold to the public as a thing that would deliver babies, but it's still about 30% of those who have IVF procedures actually get a baby. That's the first thing. So it's very expensive and pretty unreliable, really. Now, of course, we've got coming on the scene surrogacy, which is the law is about to be changed, at least seriously discussed in New South Wales. Until now, Australia has only allowed altruistic surrogacy. Woman who carries the child doesn't get paid. But now there are serious conversations all over the place about a marketplace for women who are willing to carry a child for who knows how much. But it's certainly from the US experience, at least, and I think in the Ukraine it was big business as well. You've got the underclass of women who are in financial difficulty and so on, agreeing to have children for other people, you know, being exploited, really. And now, of course, we've got gay couples wanting to have children and wanting to have surrogates to do that for them. So we need some very, very much more strict controls on this industry. Another concern we have in particular about Monash IVF, and we see that the chief executive officer has just fallen on his sword and resigned as a result of the mismanagement there. But they were also, several years ago, under a new law, the Maves law, given the opportunity to research mitochondrial replacement that really goes across the red line into germline gene manipulation, where future generations would inherit the new traits introduced only for the purpose of allowing a woman who's suffering from mitochondrial disease have a biologically related child, which is really exploitative as well.
And it's a huge industry, isn't it?
Well, yes, it's grown dramatically right round the world, really. And, of course, our states in Australia are the ones who are supposed to regulate it, but the regulations differ very much from state to state. And I think there's a need now for the federal government to take a pretty serious, stern look at the whole picture and to decide on the basis, of course, community concern and community opinion about exactly what will be allowed. I think that the commercialization of it, especially through surrogacy and other mechanisms, is really starting to just commodify life. Genetic engineering, of course, has been commodifying every living thing for a pretty long time now. But when we start talking about human beings being commodified, eggs and sperm, and of course, there's a whole strand of thought about improving the human race. And we saw what eugenics in the 20th century did and what it led to under the Nazi regime. So those ideas are still alive and well. Eugenics was practiced in many, many countries, including Australia, with some pretty dire and awful consequences, particularly discrimination against women who were thought to be unfit to have children.
Well, from babies to food produced using gene technology.
Yes, well, our Food Standards Authority, Australia New Zealand Food Standards Code, has just been changed to change the definitions of food produced in gene technology, gene technology itself. So there are new breeding techniques that they now want to incorporate into the production of food, particularly so-called gene editing. So the new focus for food standards is on the end product, not the method of production. So they're saying, in a very, very narrow sense, if the end product of food appears to be safe, that is, it doesn't make you sick or kill you in the short term, then it should be permitted to come in some cases, without any regulation at all. And that's a global trend. The industry has been putting pressure on Europe in particular, where the community is very strongly for GM-free, to accept new regulations, which will do rather like what Food Standards is doing here and the US Department of Agriculture and Food Regulation have been doing for a long, long time now. It's really industrializing the food supply, just as I said, looking at the end products rather than caring about how these foods are produced.
Well, to me, it just changes the concept of what is food.
Well, it does indeed, because coming on the scene now and pretty much deregulated by the current changes is the production of so-called meat from the actual cells of animals in fermentation processes. And there is now a company called Vow in Australia, which has started to produce quail meat in this way. We've got concerns about the concoctions that need to be used to induce this process, particularly the use of growth promotants and other substances that, although they claim they don't end up in the end product, may affect what's produced. And already Vow is producing about 100 kilos of fake quail meat each month and exporting it to Singapore, where you can buy it for $200 a plate in high-end restaurants. So it's still very expensive and probably won't be in high demand, but sometime soon it will be in restaurants in Australia, will be unlabeled, will be promoted as probably a novelty in the first instance until the price comes down.
You wonder where all this leads the farmers when their products are being changed in so many ways.
Well, yes, it's either get big or get out of farming these days, and the corporatisation of farming itself is an issue that we could have a look at on another occasion. You know, regenerative agriculture, the organic agriculture industry and so on are still small niche markets, but people are more and more demanding food that's real food, that is going to make you well, not just give you energy and keep you going. In the long term, of course, where there's no real research of what the impacts of food is, we need to understand better what the impacts of agrochemicals, which are liberally sprayed, hundreds of them, on farms, on corporate farms, especially the broadacre industry. Start thinking about how do we stay healthy and well, thinking about what we eat, because fresh fruits and vegetables are clearly superior to the ultra-processed foods that are high in fats and sugars and salt that now we're induced to buy in our supermarkets. And of course, that huge industry, which is a global industry, we're all familiar with the names, Cadbury's, Nestle, and so on. Those companies rule the roost as far as food and food production is concerned. Ultra-processed foods are now acknowledged even by food standards itself as being a threat to human heart health, diabetes, obesity, and a whole range of other things. But of course, under the influence of the industry, they're really still doing nothing that's worthwhile about restricting people's overconsumption of those junk foods. Of course, a large section of our community is in the invidious position of only being able to afford those cheap and nasty junk foods.
I know there are less farmers now because of the broadacre farming, but the impact on farmers and also the farm animals of the chemicals that have been used over those decades.
And we still have a cocktail of literally thousands of different chemicals being used. I suppose the standout one from a publicity point of view is Roundup, which has seen that Bayer is thinking of making Monsanto bankrupt in order to escape from having to fulfill its commitments to all the people who have got non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Unfortunately, the class actions in Australia didn't fly, but in the USA, there are literally tens of thousands of people in the court system demanding recompense for the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma through their repeated exposures to Roundup, to glyphosate-based herbicides. Bayer has already settled for something around $11 billion with something like 100,000 people. But the publicity here now has made people much more aware. I think that there are issues here as well, that exposure to that and other chemicals like paraquat, for instance, which is now being reviewed by the Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority, those are all damaging the environment, damaging the health and well-being of the workers on farms who use them, on golf courses, in parks, and in other places where they're not adequately protected from exposure. Really, when they get sick, they're not compensated. And then, of course, the residues of those chemicals end up in the food supply as well. So we're all being exposed. The health of us all, if we're eating conventional foods, is being degraded the whole time. And we wonder why we have all sorts of health problems. Well, that's one of the key issues.
3 weeks' time, it's the election, another election in Tasmania, as they say. What are the issues concerning Gene Ethics Network?
Well, there has been a proposal by the Minister for Primary Industries there, not out for public comment, but we were alerted some time ago that the Tasmanian government's 2025 scan of genetically manipulated organisms was proposing a change. At the moment, Tasmania is GM-free and it's a system that's been working very well now for two decades. What the government is proposing is that a certain class of genetic engineering methods would be allowed, because they're deregulated elsewhere, it would be allowed into the state, and those products would be not notified at all to the government or anybody else. They wouldn't be assessed and they would be unlicensed. So we would see an unravelling, I think, of Tasmania's GM-free status, which has been a great marketing tool and a very good production system for Tasmanian farmers and shoppers. Did alert those who are on our mailing lists, and we did put out media release, which none of the media covered, to alert people. But we are now doing, because the election's coming up on July 19th, it was just announced last week, we will put out a 10-question survey to all the political parties and see what they think about this idea, what they're going to promise to electors during the election. And it's going to be interesting, I think, to see what they all say. Most of them will not be aware that it is even going on, but I think when we put it to them, we hope for some thoughtful responses, which we will then be able to publicise as a scorecard for electors in the election on July 19th.
Well, if GM-free policies have been working, where's the push coming to change it?
Yes, good question. And I imagine it's come from the GM industry. We have CropLife in particular, that's an organisation based in Canberra that's probably the most influential lobby on both genetic engineering technologies in food and farming, and also on agrochemicals, because they represent almost all of the companies that are selling genetically engineered seed and crop plants into Australia, and also virtually all of the companies, which are the same companies, incidentally, that market the thousands of agrochemicals that come into Australia. So CropLife Australia, part of a network of organisations that operate in 92 countries around the world, would be the most influential. And of course, they're the ones who tipped over the prohibition when South Australia, until quite recently, was GM-free. CropLife were the key pivot that got government there to lift the ban on genetically engineered crops in South Australia. So they are actively beavering away in any way they can to remove any constraints on the marketing, and a very profitable marketing, of both genetically engineered crop plants and agrochemicals. That's their business, that's what they do, and they're very closely connected, let's say, particularly to the Federal Labor Party, but also to the other parties there, particularly the Nationals, who, of course, have got a lot of control in the country.
Well, if the major parties are in favour, are there any independents who have a voice?
Well, yes, there are independents, and we've been talking to the Teals and others. Pocock in Canberra is a good voice for restraint on these things. I think also, don't forget the Greens. Although they've taken a hit, the Greens have good policies which apply the precautionary principle to both genetic engineering and agrochemical exposures. We keep talking to them and encouraging them to extend their policies and be as proactive as they can on trying to get regenerative agriculture, organic and biodynamic systems featured more in the news media, which finally they are, and adopted by both farmers and shoppers as a way of producing excellent fruits, vegetables and grains as the basis for a healthy food supply.
But what about for Tasmania?
Well, Tasmania has been reaping the benefits of its exports, because something like 70% of all commodity production in Australia is actually exported overseas. And that's what their focus is on. Australia is a relatively small market, and everybody runs to, the export situation. Tasmania has been exporting its premium quality and GM-free products abroad for these last couple of decades and longer, benefiting as a community and as a state very much. And I think it would just be very foolish for them to give up those advantages. And we've certainly argued the case very strongly with the outgoing minister to see whether or not we can constrain them and just keep the existing GM-free policy in place until it's reviewed in 2029. They made a 10-year commitment to the policy, and it would be very unwise of them now, just 3 years out, to start tinkering with a policy and a program that's been working very, very well for them.
Well, let's get back to our friends, the mosquitoes. We've touched on this a couple of times, Bob. Has that progressed yet, that issue?
Well, it has. The Office of Gene Technology Regulator issued a risk assessment, its so-called risk assessment, risk management plan. It says that those mosquitoes are going to be benign. They're not going to have any environmental or public health impacts. And the fact that there is already a highly successful alternative strategy, which has reduced the dengue fever transmission in Queensland to zero, is of no concern to them. And yet this new program has the potential to undermine the existing very successful programs there. We're in the business at the moment of arguing the point, not only with the Office of Gene Technology Regulator. Their public consultation process concludes on July the 7th. So we're trying to encourage anybody and everybody with an interest in this to have a say on application DIR 207. Everybody can find it if they Google DIR 207. Because, of course, one of the little tidbits in the application is, oh, we're only going to ask to release the mosquitoes in Queensland, but if they go to other states, then we'll apply later for them to be have national approval. That's where we're up to with that at the moment. We're also very much trying to get the state government, which has been very laid back about the whole thing, to actually have an inquiry to see what Queensland people think, because there have been a couple of well-supported petitions. One of them to the parliament had 7,500 signatures. The state government needs to act as well.
I wouldn't have thought that mosquitoes take much notice of state boundaries.
Well, that's right, although they do take notice of climate. So as climate has changed, we see mosquitoes are moving to new environments and are having their impacts there as well. And, of course, the other thing about the Oxitec mosquitoes, the genetically engineered ones, is that they will actually be Mexican mosquitoes. So we're going to bring in an invasive species. We're going to rely on the very poor data produced by the company itself, because there really hasn't been any independent research on this, and believe that they will just sell them to anybody and everybody who wants to buy them for release any time and anywhere, initially in Queensland, that they won't have any impacts. And yet we know mosquitoes are really critical as pollinators in Northern Australia, and they also are a very important food source for a lot of other organisms like bats, frogs, fish, dragonflies, and a whole raft of other insects and animals that rely on mosquitoes as part of the food supply and the food cycle in Northern Australia and increasingly in other states as well.
These mosquitoes won't come as mosquitoes, will they? They'll come as larvae? Is that what will happen? If it does.
Eggs, yes, eggs. As mosquito eggs, yeah, which will, I think the product that they're going to first try to sell here is a box with the eggs in it. You add water, put it out in the sun, and the eggs will hatch, and then you'll have millions of mosquitoes, which will release themselves to various environments. We already have the Wolbachia strategy. The World Mosquito Program has been working since 2010. In Northern Australia, on a system which involves the introduction, a sustainable, I should say, strategy which introduces Wolbachia bacterium to mosquitoes and stops the female mosquitoes, which is the one that bite people, from transferring dengue fever from person to person. So the mosquitoes are only a vector. Rather than killing the mosquitoes, crashing the population, and endangering environments and public health, the Wolbachia strategy puts this bacterium into the mosquito population. They transmit it to each other and to their offspring. It's a sustainable system. You don't have to keep repeating the sale of genetically engineered mosquitoes in order to make the thing work. Great for the company, great business model, but Wolbachia is already doing it. So in 2013, they had, I believe, 236 cases locally acquired of dengue in northern Queensland. And in 2022-23, it was zero. So there's a system already working. One of our arguments is don't endanger what already works. But of course, the OGTR says that's none of our business.
So it's proposal DIR 207.
And put in an OGTR if you just want to be sure that you'll find it. And there it is. The closure of public submissions is on the 7th of July. And if anybody wants further information, they can get it from info@geneethics.org.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.